What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.
One of the things that the Iran-Contra scandal was, it set up what was called the Office of Public Diplomacy in 1983. And it was basically ran of the State Department, but it was staffed by psych operatives drawn from the Department of Defense and drawn by the CIA that worked in tandem with Republican-controlled public relations firms. The whole point was to shift the narrative, to retrain and re-educate reporters who had become too critical. And the Office of Public Diplomacy laid out a campaign that is unbelievably ambitious. I mean, they used polling firms to figure out how to frame the debate. This is when the word terrorism began to be substituted for communism because it was more emotional. And the Office of Public Diplomacy wrote articles and planted them in the press. So jump forward 2 decades later, and you have people like Cindy Embers and Jonathan Chott, who are the products of that re-education.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Halper Show. Please rate and review us on iTunes. You can listen to us on SoundCloud. You can also support us on Patreon, which is patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Now, in exchange for a certain level of Patreon support, you get bonus episodes, entire extended interviews, entire interviews that stand on their own. But you can also just support the show to support the show. And I'm just putting it out there, not just for the quid pro quo of it, although that's great. You get basically twice as much content. But if you just like the show, you think that we do important interviews, you like hearing from people like Greg Grandin, then please do support the show. And again, you can do that at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Greg Grandin is a historian and NYU professor of history and the author of a number of prize-winning books, including most recently, The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. Other books by Greg include Empire's Workshop, Latin America, the United States, and the Rise of the New Empire. Greg Grandin has been on the show before, and he's one of my favorite guests. And I wanted to have him on to give a much needed history lesson to Sydney Ember, who is a journalist at the New York Times, and also to Jonathan Chait, who defended Ember, and to basically everyone who thinks that Sanders' support of the Sandinistas in 1985 is at all problematic. The piece we're talking about in particular is one called Mayor and Foreign Minister, How Bernie Sanders Brought the Cold War to Burlington. Referendums, rallies, a trip to Nicaragua, all were part of his effort to infuse left-wing activism into local politics. And it's co-written by Alexander Burns and Sydney Ember. But for all intents and purposes, it's by Sydney Ember in that this is one of the 18 pieces that Sydney Ember has written at the New York Times that are either overtly or somewhat covertly critical of Bernie Sanders. So I just refer to the piece as written by her because, again, she co-writes a lot of pieces, but she's the common denominator among all these pieces that attack Bernie Sanders. Also, she is the person who did the follow-up interview, which is pretty embarrassing, but her name is on it, not her co-writer, Alexander Burns. His name is not on it. Lucky for him. Diane Ravitch called her out the other day because she pretended that a guy who has no real education policy experience was a guy with education policy experience. He's really just a lobbyist and a lawyer. I mean, you can just take a look. Bernie Sanders is making changes for 2020, but his desire for control remains. That's one headline. Another thing that she wrote about Sanders based on nothing was, for Bernie Sanders, holding on to support may be hard in a 2020 bid. No evidence. You can see her pieces on Sanders where she makes things up about him, how he's outflanked on the left by Beto O'Rourke, which is kind of a weirdly stupid thing to say just because it's so debunkable. Then she did four articles over the course of a couple days on the sexual harassment allegations against staffers on the Sanders campaign. She, of course, never wrote about the sexual harassment allegations against staffers on the Kirsten Gillibrand campaign or against people who worked for Kamala Harris when she was attorney general. So that's an interesting contrast. Anyway, you get the point. So this is just the latest embersism against Bernie Sanders. And so what happened was that she wrote an article about him, this really McCarthyist red-baiting hit piece. And Sanders, surprisingly enough, didn't want to talk to her because, again, she has a documented history of smearing him. So he didn't want to talk to her. Then she wrote this hit piece. Then he did want to talk to her, so they did an interview. In the interview, she asked him, in the top of our story, we talk about the rally you attended in Managua, and a Wire report at the time said there were anti-American chants from the crowd. You do recall hearing those chants? I think the Wire report has them saying, here, there, everywhere, the Yankee will die. My point was, I wanted to know if you had heard that. Do you think if you had heard that directly, you would have stayed at the rally? Do you believe you had an accurate view of President Ortega at the time? I'm wondering if now you view Ortega and the government differently, knowing what you do now. Is there anything you believed about Latin America or the Soviet Union in the 1980s that you no longer believe today? Oh, this is the weirdest question. During your visit to Yaroslavl, you contrasted the American and Soviet economic systems and praised aspects of the Soviet system, like the free provision of healthcare and the efficiency of mass transit. Do you still admire these aspects of the Soviet system? Does anyone not like those aspects of any system? Anyway, the New York Times does this thing where they have a reporter ask an unfair question. They did this with Yamiche Alcindor, who asked Sanders what he had to say to people who say that it's sexist for him to not drop out.
What do you say to women who say that you staying in the race is sexist because you're standing in the way of what could be the first female president?
Is that a serious question?
Yes, it is a serious question.
That any woman who is running for president, so if Hillary Clinton runs for president, is your point that it is sexist for any man to oppose her?
No, my point is that if she has more delegates than you tomorrow...
Well, that's another point. That is not...
Sexist.
Well, I don't think it is sexist.
So they do this. They have a pattern of doing this. They ask a loaded, unfair leading question. Sanders bristles, as is understandable. And then the media makes the story about how Sanders is mean or crotchety or bad at answering questions, as opposed to the real story being about how the media likes to pick on Sanders. To be fair, Bernie Sanders did say, this was not about Ortega. Do you understand? I don't know if you do or not. Do you know that the United States overthrew the government of Chile way back? Do you happen to know that? Do you? I'm asking you a simple question. And she said, what point do you want to make? Which, by the way, is a pretty good hint that she has no idea about what's happening in Chile. Because if I were in her shoes and I was annoyed at Sanders and thought he was being rude, I would just say, yeah, of course I know about Allende and Pinochet, but... Anyway, she doesn't do that, though. She just says, what point do you want to make? Which is a nice dodge. And he says, my point is that fascism developed in Chile. As a result of that, the United States overthrew the government of Guatemala, a democratically elected government overthrew the government of Brazil. I strongly oppose U.S. policy, which overthrows governments, especially democratically elected governments around the world. So the issue is not so much Nicaragua, the government of Nicaragua. The issue was, should the United States continue a policy of overthrowing governments in Latin America and Central America? I believed then that it was wrong, and I believe today it is wrong. That's why I do not believe the United States should overthrow the government of Venezuela. So then Jonathan Chait, in his breathtakingly stupid defense of Ember, which I actually think just makes her and himself look like idiots, he writes, Bernie's pro-Sandinista past is a problem, and his response is not good. A week ago, the New York Times reported on Bernie Sanders' 1980s vintage foreign policy stance, which at times crossed over from mere opposition to American policy to outright support for communist governments. Sanders initially refused to speak with the reporters, but after the article appeared, he called one of them and gave an extremely crusty interview. What the hell is crusty? Now he has a video framing the issue, which he says is about my opposition to war and refusal to apologize for his opinions.
Recently, I've been criticized a bit because of my opposition to war and my belief that we got to do everything possible to solve international conflict without going to war. So let me be very clear. I make no apologies to anybody that when I was a young man, before I was elected to anything, I opposed the war in Vietnam. And I know what that war did to my generation. And when I was a member of the House, I helped lead the effort against the war in Iraq because I knew that Cheney and Bush and these other folks were lying about weapons of mass destruction.
I'm opposed to giving the president a blank check to launch a unilateral invasion and occupation of Iraq, and why I will vote against this resolution.
And that war and that vote was the worst foreign policy blunder in the modern history of the United States. And as a senator, I'm proud that I helped for the first time in 45 years to utilize the War Powers Act to get the United States out of an unauthorized war in Yemen. Unfortunately, after passing in the House and the Senate, Trump vetoed that legislation. And I'll tell you something, that right now, I'm going to do everything that I can to prevent a war with Iran. Because if you think that the war in Iraq was a disaster, my guess is that the war in Iran would be even worse. So let's work together and prevent that war. If people want to criticize me for that, go for it. That's okay. I don't apologize to anybody. Thank you.
Jonathan Chait, he writes, any politician is going to frame issues selectively, but Sanders is presenting a spin on the controversy so selective it completely fails to convey any of the points relevant to the controversy. During the 1980s, the Reagan administration was giving military aid to the Contras, a right-wing guerrilla insurgency attacking the Nicaraguan government. Most Democrats opposed aiding the Contras while still deploring the communist Nicaragua government. The Times shows that Sanders went well beyond mere opposition to funding the war. He wrote to Sandinista leaders that American news media had not reflected fairly the goals and accomplishments of your administration. On a visit to the country, he attended a Sandinista celebration at which the crowd chanted, "Here, there, everywhere, the Yankee will die," and complained that American reporters ignored the truth, quote unquote, the truth about Nicaragua's government, telling a CBS reporter, "You are worms," end quote. So it's because of that Chait says, this is all highly relevant to his presidential campaign and not only sheds light on his foreign policy thinking, but also illustrates the sorts of attacks Sanders would face in a general election if nominated. Given that he identifies as a democratic socialist and promises radical change, his defensive comments about a communist regime would help Republicans paint him in the most extreme light. Well, Jonathan, you are really giving them a leg up, aren't you, by doing the work ahead of time? I can't stand this guy. He's so dishonest. Just stop pretending that you're doing this for pragmatic reasons and you want to protect him and the Democrats from unfair Republican attacks. You're doing those Republican attacks. I mean, I don't know if you don't realize it. We can't play this game. It requires too much. Chait is such an idiot. Chait is such a reactionary idiot. He doesn't even realize that there's something problematic about expecting that Sanders would just hate a communist regime. Of course, he calls it a communist regime, by the way. It's another hint. So again, Sanders' real problem, his unforgivable mistakes are being at a rally where people said anti-American things, telling the Sandinistas that the media in the United States wasn't representing them well, or weren't representing them fairly. Thank you, Jonathan Chait, for proving his point. And also, or saying that the American media were worms. Again, thank you, Chait, for proving him right. And of course, Sidney Ember is the victim. He berated the reporter, Sidney Ember, with insinuations that she lacks a basic factual understanding of the issues. But she does seem to lack that. Ember is asking a pertinent factual question. Did Sanders hear the Yankees will die chant? His response to the question is to insist she is unaware of major historical events in the region. So for the sake of Chait, Ember, the New York Times, Chuck Todd.
All right, I want to move to some foreign policy. There's New York Times spent a lot of time talking about your trips to Central America. Yeah. I know you got pretty worked up about those things. I think the larger question, let me just frame the question this way. The larger question is going to be, if you're the nominee, whether you like it or not, the right's going to basically hammer and sickle you to death. How do you prevent it?
Well, I don't mind the right wing doing it, but I understand they will do it. I don't want the media to do it.
For the sake of Chait, Ember, the New York Times, Chuck Todd, everyone else who's doesn't seem to understand Latin American history or politics, I speak to Greg Grandin, and also I cut in some audio from a news report, and that is from West 57th, which is a CBS show, and the correspondent on the episode that I play is Jane Wallace. So excited to have Greg Grandin on to talk about this work of performance art, unintentional performance art, that is an article written by Sydney Ember. And Sydney Ember, by the way, her father-in-law is CEO at Bain.
Oh.
And she used to work at BlackRock investment firm. And so I thought we could go over the article and the interview. We don't have to read all of it, obviously. For like the sake of your well-being, I wouldn't want to subject you to that. So for Daniel Ortega, the president of Nicaragua, the summer of 1985 was to be a moment of extraordinary triumph. In July, on the sixth anniversary of the Sandinista Revolution, Mr. Ortega would address a crowd of hundreds of thousands with a message of defiance for his political nemesis, Ronald Reagan, and the Contra militias waging war on him with support from Washington. Amid the festivities, Mr. Ortega would also meet with the mayor of Burlington, Vermont, Bernie Sanders, then 43. Who journeyed for 14 hours to reach Nicaragua. Aspects of the trip might have unsettled another visitor. A reporter who traveled with Mr. Sanders wrote of strict limits on the taking of photographs. At the university celebration, a wire report described a chant rising up. Here, there, everywhere, the Yankee will die. If Mr. Sanders harbored unease about the Sandinistas, he did not dwell on it. After many years of economic and political domination, Nicaragua is determined not to be a banana republic anymore, and it's free to make its own decisions, Mr. Sanders declared, according to a Nicaraguan newspaper, El Nuevo Diario,
nice.
Quoting him in Spanish. Is this a crime? She says, a New York Times review of Mr. Sanders' mayoral papers, including hundreds of speeches, handwritten notes, letters, political pamphlets, and domestic and foreign newspapers, clippings from a period spanning nearly a decade revealed that from his earliest days in office, Mr. Sanders aimed to execute his own foreign policy, repudiating Mr. Reagan's approach of aggressively backing anti-communist governments and resistance forces.
Reagan came to office in 1980, committed to rolling back what he and his supporters understood to be a socialist wave in Central America, and he ratcheted up military support to the death squads in El Salvador, death squads in Guatemala, and the Contras in Nicaragua. What wasn't mentioned in that article, I mean, Daniel Ortega might have been, you know, it should have been a triumphal moment for him in that vote, but he was just elected in an election that was universally understood to be fair and above board.
Right. So that's what's interesting. She, I think, maybe forgot that something bad was supposed to happen. Like, it's very ominous sounding, right? The summer of 1985 was to be a moment of extraordinary triumph. But then nothing bad happens that she refers to. Except for maybe that Bernie comes. Does she think it's not fun to hang out with Bernie?
Well, it was a bad year for the war. I mean, the Contras were, you know, the organized remnants of Somoza's National Guard, Somoza being the dictator that was overthrown in 1979, that Jimmy, we could talk about the specifics of Jimmy Carter, but Jimmy Carter's policy towards Nicaragua was ambivalent, to say the least. He gestured support of the Sandinistas, but then tried to contain them at the same time. And anyway, he was seen as waffling and weak by the supporters of Reagan, and they immediately moved to organize the opposition, the right-wing opposition, into this paramilitary force based in Honduras and based in Costa Rica that carried out unimaginably acts of atrocity that you know, that were routinely condemned.
We came to find an American nun who lives in the middle of this war. She's appalled by what she sees of the war her country pays for. The Contras, she says, are deliberately targeting civilians. Gregorio Davila was orphaned by them.
Family was murdered by the Contra in November when the baby was 6 days old.
The parents were murdered?
Yes.
Other members of the family as well?
A brother of the mother, his girlfriend, the four-year-old brother of this baby. Contra attacked about 20 of them in one night.
Gregorio's sister, Guadalupe, witnessed the attack.
Did they shoot them?
Los tiraron.
Sí. Y a mi papá y cuya.
They slit his throat.
How about your mother?
¿Qué le hicieron a tu mamá?
La mataron y después la desnudaron.
They killed her and then they took her clothes off.
Después le quemaron la ropa y le pelaron la cara.
They burned her clothes and then they peeled off her face.
They were out and out terrorists, and they used terror as a political tactic.
The tactics are what we call terrorist tactics. They are not military tactics.
Edgar Chamorro was one of the top political leaders of the Contra group, FDN. He was fired last November, the FDN says, for incompetence.
Sometimes terror is very productive. Terror makes people to give in, to not to fight. You know, they end up by accepting the Contra because they fear them.
The idea wasn't necessarily to overthrow the Sandinistas, because they didn't think that was possible, but certainly to do two things. One, destabilize them, and two, make them act in the way that their opponents believe, you know, said that they were, right? Because how do you respond to a war financed by the most powerful nation in world history, other than by having to crack down on civil liberties? I mean, right. The horror of having limits placed on what photos were taken.
Right, right. Yeah, how does that compare to
Cristina Diaz when she was left for dead after an attack in Father Feltz's parish?
A girl of 11 years old who was visiting her uncle, that was her crime. And her uncle, in some way, was a member of a Sandinista support committee. After they burned his house and killed several of the members of his household, a fellow shot at her from horseback first and missed and told somebody else to shoot her.
You got shot four times?
Te balearon cuatro veces.
Sí. Y ahí me dijeron que me embrocar.
They told you to lay down, face down.
On the ground?
En el suelo, sí. Y después me tiraron.
And then they shot her.
I mean, here's the thing. Anybody who was paying attention in Nicaragua in the mid-1980s who had any decency whatever would have been opposed to what Reagan was doing. The Contras weren't incidental. They were the centerpiece of this move by movement conservatives to destabilize and turn into the authoritarian caricature, the Sandinistas into the authoritarian caricature that they said they were. The Contras were remnants of Somoza's National Guard. They were brutal. They were organized by the CIA. They were aided by a whole panoply of private right-wing organizations that was all part of the scandal that was Iran-Contra. And they were responsible for something like 50,000 deaths. And they specifically targeted all of the symbols of Sandinistas won a revolution. They were trying to establish sovereignty in the hinterland of a country. They set up health clinics. They set up, they were trying to create electrical plants. They set up schools, and those were specifically the targets that were destroyed by the Contras. And any kind of, you know, literacy workers, the engineers, anybody who was involved in trying to create the new Nicaraguan nation were targeted by the Contras.
Pedro and Felix Espinales used to live in a farming cooperative that doesn't exist anymore. It was wiped out by the Contras last year. 35 people were killed, half of those women and children. Some of the men, including their father, were members of the local militia. The twins survived the killing that left their father and friends dead in a ditch.
Then they finished off a couple of kids that were just wounded.
They finished them off, they killed them?
Yes.
In front of you kids?
En frente de ustedes lo mataron.
Sí.
What happened to your daddy? What happened
¿Qué
to your daddy?
A su papá?
They
pulled off the skin off his face and his feet.
contras carried out a policy of torture and rape and scorched earth. And the point wasn't so much to overthrow the Sandinistas. Nobody really thought the Sandinistas could be overthrown by the Contras, but just to show that the Sandinistas couldn't establish sovereignty and control on the board in the borderland areas where the Contras moved in and out of from Honduras and Costa Rica. They were brutal and they were roundly condemned by all decent people. So that's kind of uncontroversial that Sanders opposed right. the Contras. That seems to be a basic thing. What's more interesting about it is that Nicaragua and the Contra War were part of the new right's attempt to regain control of the narrative, the thread that was lost after Vietnam, mm-hmm. right? Vietnam, I mean, Sandinistas win in 1979. Sanders is in Managua in 1985. That's just 10 years after the U.S., you know, had to pull out of Saigon, and those famous photographs of the kind of nadir or of American power, those helicopters falling off the aircraft carriers as right. the U.S. was kicked out of Southeast Asia. And the new right, who rallied around Ronald Reagan, came to power committed to regaining both the military and moral high ground. And when I mean moral high ground, I don't mean that what they did was moral. I meant that they could justify it in moral terms, right?
They are the moral equal of our founding fathers and the brave men and women of the French Resistance. We cannot turn away from them. But the struggle here is not right versus left. It is right versus wrong.
They wanted to end exactly the kind of skepticism, the kind of cynicism, and the kind of organized opposition to U.S. foreign policy that Sanders and a whole generation that came of age in Vietnam represented. And the place that they did that was Nicaragua. And one of the things that the Iran-Contra scandal was, that is less not really talked about, aside from selling the high-tech missiles to Islamic Iran and diverting the money to the Contras.
But much of the Contras' funding came from the cocaine trade. Because of this, Congress passed the Boland Amendment, specifically aimed at keeping American money from funding the group. That happened in 1982, shortly after Reagan took office. The amendment restricted the CIA and Department of Defense from using funds to provide military assistance to groups that were trying to overthrow Nicaragua's government. Groups like the Contras. This didn't stop Reagan. The president told his national security advisor, Robert McFarlane, to help the Contras anyway, regardless of the cost. McFarlane found opportunity in Iran. In 1985, an Iranian-backed terrorist group held 7 American hostages in Lebanon. So with permission from Reagan, McFarlane made a deal. The U.S. would give Iran weapons, and Iran would broker the release of the hostages. This happened even though Reagan publicly insisted he would not negotiate with terrorists, and despite the fact that there was a trade embargo with Iran. But that was just the tip of the iceberg. The deal with Iran didn't just secretly secure the release of the hostages in exchange for weapons. There was money involved. While $30 million had been allocated for the weapons, the CIA funneled a portion of that money to the Contras in Nicaragua. Only $12 million of the $30 million actually went toward weapons for Iran. The rest of the money was sent to the Contras in Nicaragua.
She has this total euphemism for the Contras where she says it like embroiled the president in legal scandal because he defied Congress. Like, he didn't yes. break the law, he just defied Congress restrictions.
And one of the things that the Iran-Contra scandal was, it set up what was called the Office of Public Diplomacy in 1983. And it was basically ran of the State Department, but it was staffed by psych operatives drawn from the Department of Defense and drawn by the CIA that worked in tandem with Republican-controlled public relations firms. It was headed by Otto Reich and then Robert Kagan. And the whole point of it, the whole point was to shift the narrative, to retrain and re-educate reporters who had gone off the reservation, who had become too critical. And not just reporters, but a public that even if you weren't actively opposed to U.S. foreign policy, you kind of believed the worst of the U.S. And the Office of Public Diplomacy laid out a campaign, I talk about it in Empire's Workshop, that is an unbelievably ambitious. I mean, they They used polling firms to figure out how to frame the debate. This is when the word terrorism was began to be substituted for communism because it was more emotional and easier. This is when the word, when anti-Semitism as a charge for U.S. enemies began to be, just because it polled well. And the Office of Public Diplomacy wrote articles and planted them in the press. So jump forward, whatever, how many, you know, two decades later, and you have people like Cindy Embers and Jonathan Chott, who are the products of that re-education. They don't have to be induced to do it or tricked.
Right. Well, you know, Greg, you're going to be really happy because guess who Cindy Ember cites? Do you know this? She actually,
Otto Reich.
Yeah, she cited Otto Reich, a very fair and balanced source. Otto Reich, a former special envoy for Latin America, who helped oversee Nicaragua policy for the Reagan administration, said that by the middle of the 1980s, a politician like Mr. Sanders should have known better than to fawn over Mr. Ortega. By the way, fawn is her word. So he says should have known better, that's his quote, than to fawn over Mr. Ortega. Mr. Reich noted that prominent liberals like John F. Kerry, then a senator from Massachusetts, had met with Ortega, Mr. Ortega in Nicaragua, but had not actually celebrated him. And then she quotes Reich as saying, "He has, by virtue of these travels and associations, joined up with some of the most repressive regimes in the world."
Yeah. Otto Reich wasn't just, he was an envoy for Latin America during George W. Bush. Under Ronald Reagan, what he was the head of the Office of Public Diplomacy, which was one of the most corrupting and degrading instrument of U.S. democracy one could imagine. It was basically, it's against the law, actually, to run psychological operations against U.S. citizens. And this it's in the National Security Directive and all of and right. a series of laws. This figured out ways to circumvent them, It targeted the press. It targeted organizations like CISPIS. It raised the cost of reporting critically on El Salvador. And as I mentioned earlier, they used polling firms to figure out how to frame the debate in the simplest possible terms. Look, the vast majority of people didn't know who we were supporting in Nicaragua, who we were supporting in El Salvador. You know, we were supporting the government in El Salvador, the government in Nicaragua. Most people didn't know that.
Including Sidney Ember,
clearly.
The point
was to take that low base of knowledge and frame it in even simpler terms. So, you know, the Contras are freedom fighters. Nicaragua is linked to Gaddafi and terrorism and anti-Semitism, and just constantly beat those themes. You know, there's a lot of sources of fake news and what we call fake news and the epistemological crisis that we're all living in. It's not all, but a good, you know, one source of it is the kind of the destabilization and disinformation campaign that the U.S. has used in other countries coming back home to the United States, in the Contra, particularly in the Contra War. The Reagan Central American policy was the main instrument that the new right used to try to restore an imperial presidency, to overcome what they saw as apathy, Bernie Sanders was an organized socialist, not even that. Just a general sense of cynicism and skepticism about U.S. purpose in the world. And the new right policy was meant to overcome that, and they used Nicaragua to do that. And so that's the irony of all of this. That
right.
You know, that Ember Sidney, or Sidney Ember, or whatever her name is. You know,
her beat is bashing Bernie.
She's a product of that.
Right. They're showing, not telling.
She makes all of these gestures towards the, you know, authoritarianism in the Sandinistas government in the 1980s. But she's the one, unknowingly, who has been, her and her cohort has gone through the re-education.
Jonathan Chait brought up the anti-Semitism thing. I don't know if you saw this, but I just want to give him credit, because you probably know that Jonathan Chait went after Ilhan Omar for a speech in which she talked about allegiance, from which he extrapolated that she was making a reference to the dual loyalty trope, a trope that is so obscure. But Jonathan Chait was sure, you know, he had to go after her for that. Now, skip forward a little bit. Politico had a piece about Sanders about his secret million. Yeah. Now, Greg, I want to make sure you get this because it's lost on a lot of people. It's very nuanced. It says that he's he may be cheap, but he's not poor. And he's standing in one image. He's standing holding two houses and has with a third one on his head. And in another image, he's standing in front of a tree, which has money dollar bill, right, which has dollars instead of leaves. So you may not get this, though, Greg.
I know.
It's very deep. It's very subtle.
There's a picture of a baby on a plate in the corner, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What's so funny is I tweeted out. I said something like, you just need the dollar signs in his eyes. You missed that. And then I saw in the actual article the tree, the money tree thing. And I was like, I spoke too soon. You actually did lay everything out. And of course, they misrepresented the wealth of all these people. But Jonathan Chait was so busy writing a follow-up to Ember's piece that he didn't get a chance to even tweet about the anti-Semitic tropes that he must have missed because they're so subtle in this Politico piece. But, you know, Batya from The Forward, who I'm not a fan of, she at least had the kind of wherewithal to appear consistent. Yeah. So she was the one who really unfairly went after Ilhan Omar. At least she tweeted something about Politico. You didn't hear anything from Meghan McCain, Clinton, Jonathan Chait, and it's infuriating, but they're also doing us a favor in a way because they're just kind of revealing and owning what disingenuous opportunists they are and how little they care about anti-Semitism, actually. But what do you think of this question that that Sydney Ember asked Bernie Sanders? Because her major question to him was if he had heard that chant, that death to the Yankee chant. So this is her big moment to interview Sanders. And Sanders didn't want to do it, maybe because this woman's beat is literally like her beat. I think probably the New York Times has it written down that she's the Bernie basher in residence. I mean, all she does is talk about him. And Diane Ravitch had a great piece about her. Just to get a sense of her honesty, it's not just that she has terrible politics, it's that she ended her piece on education by quoting someone involved in education who Ravitch had never heard of, and he's a lobbyist and a lawyer. I mean, you know. But in the interview, she asks him if he had heard the anti-American chants and if he would have stayed there if he had heard it. And then, of course, Sanders gets upset and asks her, says he doesn't know if she knows what she's talking about. And then everyone said she was just doing her job, which is true if her job is, smearing Sanders and being a source of disinformation. But what do you think of that question?
It's a setup question. I don't, going back to the equivalence, it's like sticks and stones may break my bones, but things will never hurt me. It's like the AK-47s and the flamethrowers and the grenades and the landmines we provided the Contras will kill our, the village children.
I mean, it's interesting because Ember, again, she doesn't, she describes the Contras as a legal scandal. And she says that that Reagan continued to support them even as news of even despite allegations of atrocities. Was Reagan unaware of the atrocities committed by the Contras?
Right. No, look, to go back to the point that I made earlier, how the Office of Public Diplomacy figured out ways to frame the debate, to muddy the waters, right? To introduce doubt, to frame the argument. I mean, she really is just a product of that, of the Office of Public Diplomacy. And this was Otto Reich, the first or the second, but, so it was formed in January 1983, and it was set out to basically create this kind of disinformation campaign run on domestic soil. It contracted Republican associated advertising firms to kind of frame the debate. It used psychological operatives from the Department of Defense and from the CIA, and basically the office used the Nicaraguan campaign to shift the understanding away from communism, shifts concept of terrorism, right? Mm-hmm. So use focus groups to figure out that the word terrorism resonated more than the word communism. you know, equating the Sandinistas with the Nazis and charging Managua with fomenting terrorism in neighboring countries and linking them with the PLO, with Libya, with right. Arafat, with Ayatollah Khomeini. You know, it really was just a way of figuring out how to frame the debate about foreign policy in a more State Department favorable way.
While supporting terrorists, it seems like
you know, the reduction of foreign policy to a series of very emotionally laden talking points, and that linked the Sandinistas to any number of world evils, you know, began to be pushed by the Office of Public Diplomacy in coordination with U.S. politicians, and then they would write op-eds and publish them under people's names, a big new Brzezinski, you know, and just get them published. That, you know, on in Empire's Workshop, I have a list of over 2 month period, and exactly in 1985. I mean, it's a chronology of 79 tasks that the office set out to do.
Yeah,
it's
quite remarkable. Share some of them.
Okay. 1, assign U.S. intelligence agencies to research Sandinista violations of the Geneva Convention. Approach congressmen based on that research. Encourage U.S. reporters to meet individual Contra fighters. Contact internal witnesses to testify before Congress about their failed attempts to deal with the Sandinistas. Prepare a list of publicly and privately expressed congressional objections to aiding Contras, then request that Zbigniew Brzezinski write a paper which points out geopolitical consequences of communist domination of Central America. Hold briefing for key congressional members and staffs. Draft one op-ed per week for signature by for op-eds and retain final editorial rights. Conduct public opinion polling of American attitudes towards the Sandinistas. Prepare a list of key media outlets interested in Central American issues. Identify specific editors, commentators, talk shows, and columnists. Visit newspaper editorial boards and give them background on the Nicaraguan freedom fighters. And again, calling the Contras freedom fighters. And it just goes on and on and on. Release paper on Nicaraguan drug involvement. Distribute paper on geopolitical consequences. That was the one that they asked Brzezinski to organize rallies. And then with no irony, release paper on Nicaraguan media manipulation.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Again, they're showing, not telling.
Otto Reich would show up at NPR offices and lecture them about what they got wrong about by flooding the media. So the point wasn't necessarily whenever a reporter wrote about a Contra atrocity, the point wasn't necessarily to rebut it, but to flood the media with other interpretations to muddy the water, right?
Yeah.
You know, so here's Karen Burns, who worked for ABC News in 1987, right? She said, so confronted by government spokespeople and sympathetic experts ready to rebut unfavorable coverage, no matter how slight the criticism or how marginal the source, reporters came to dread the amount of fact-checking it took to cover Central America. And this is Karen Burns now. I work for a network very concerned with cost and image. It takes months and months, she said, to do a critical story on Reagan's Central American policy. Spending that much prep time on a story that would take up only 5 minutes of airtime. It was not a way to be successful. So, you know, she would just, the point was that she just covers something else.
Right.
Reich would personally tour NPR studios, and he'd let them know that the Office of Public Diplomacy had contracted, quote, a special consultant service to listen to all NPR programs on Central America, which NPR understood to be, you know, basically a threat of defunding. And it was following that visit that NPR, a high conservative, commented Linda Chavez to provide balance.
That's the liberal media, right?
NPR. Yeah. So, but the point is, this is all going on. This is all the backdrop to that, to 1985, to Sanders's visit in Managua,
right?
And how Sidney Enver seems to be exhibit A of how successful that campaign was on re-education.
Well, you're a historian, Greg, so you must appreciate that, right? That she shows the, you know, it's a lesson in historical legacies. It's so fascinating that she mentions the crimes against humanity committed by Ortega. She links to an Amnesty International report on that. The Contras, she makes it seem like Reagan didn't, like it was rumors, right? She says that there were allegations of atrocities. She says, Mr. Reagan regarded Mr. Ortega as an intolerable threat, a Marxist revolutionary with ties to the Soviet Union and Cuba, even as the Contras face mounting allegations of brutal killings and other atrocities.
So look at this. In May 1985, Newsweek ran an article that reported on these atrocities that that the Contras had committed. It was backed up by color photographs provided by a photographer, Frank Wohl, a Marine ROTC graduate, an anti-communist activist who was traveling with the Contras when he witnessed the execution of a prisoner of war, scooping the dirt out with his hand, squatting in the hole, he ate some dry powdered milk. Then the Contra executioner knelt and jammed a Kaban knife into his throat. A second enforcer stabbed at his jugular. This is all reported in Newsweek, right? This is a second enforcer stabbed at his jugular, then his abdomen. When the corpse was finally still, the Contras threw dirt over his grave and walked away. So that's when the Office of Public Diplomacy sprang into action. The photos were authentic, yet Otto Reich argued that they must have been faked because the Contra uniforms were too clean. Wohl's conservative credentials didn't stop Oliver North from accusing him of being a Sandinista sympathizer. When asked about the killing by House Speaker Tip O'Neill, Reagan simply said, "I saw that picture, and I'm told that after it was taken, the so-called victim got up and walked away."
Oh. So he's magical, I guess.
The irony of Cindy Ember talking about press control in Managua. This is May 1985.
Right, yeah.
This is exactly the moment that Sanders is there.
Yeah, I don't think that Ember knows about any of this. I mean, I think if she did know about it, she would conceal it anyway. But I actually don't think she knows what she's talking about. Can you just give kind of a, in case she's listening to the show, cause maybe she likes us because I talk about her a lot. An overview of like the greatest hits of the foreign policies that we support, that Reagan supported, because she doesn't seem to know that there were like dictatorships or juntas in Argentina. You know, she doesn't know about Guatemala. She doesn't really know about anything. Yeah. But she names El Salvador and Nicaragua, but nothing else.
Reagan came to power, you know, in the post-Vietnam realignment, and he managed to tap into a kind of backlash that caused by the 1970s, by Watergate, by Vietnam, and he came into office promising to restore American purpose and power, and he did that in a number of different ways. And explicitly, he reversed all of Jimmy Carter's human rights conditions that he placed on the dictators were already in place in South America, in Argentina, in Chile, in Brazil, but what Reagan did was that he signaled very early on that they weren't going to condition military aid human rights abuses. So there was a clear show of support for the junta in Argentina, for Pinochet in Chile, and other dictatorships. But really, it was in Central America where the Sandinistas had just won in mid-1979, in July 1979. They overthrew a dictatorship, the Somoza dictatorship. And there were left-wing insurgencies in Guatemala and in El Salvador. And Central America is important largely because many people at the time were hard-pressed to say why Reagan was so obsessed with Central America, why he was willing to call rapists and torturers and murderers the moral equivalent of our founding fathers, why he was willing to ratchet up.
Well, maybe he was really being woke and critiquing the culture incorporated into the founding of, he was just highlighting the moral bankruptcy of our slaveocracy. Yeah.
Why he was willing to spend millions of dollars to defend, support death squads in El Salvador, to publicly embraced Rios Manto in Guatemala was launching a genocide that would destroy hundreds of Mayan villages and kill hundreds of thousands of people. And to a large degree, Central America's importance was its unimportance, that it didn't have any strategic, you know, it was squarely within the U.S.'s backyard. It had no important resources. There was no superpower that was going to come to its aid. So in all of the other areas of the world where Reagan talked tough, he had to act with a degree of moderation. The Soviet Union still existed. The Middle East was volatile. I mean, he pulled out troops from Beirut. The one place, though, that he could actually give to movement conservatives and let them run wild was Central America. And that's why El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua are so important. He gave the region to, you know, and there were different currents that go into the new right. There was the Christian New Right, the Pentecostals were becoming increasingly involved in foreign policy and interested in world affairs as part of their prophetic understanding of how history was unfolding. There was the Vietnam vets like Ali North who were radicalized to the right as a result of Vietnam. There was all of the paramilitary soldier of fortune types who had become demobilized after Watergate in Vietnam because of Congress had taken away all of their covert ops. There was the secular neocons, people like Elliot Abrams, that believed that the US had to restore its authority in the world and relink that authority to some kind of moral purpose. And the place that they all came together was Central America.
So there was no cost, you're saying.
There was no cost because Reagan could let them run wild. I mean, he couldn't, you know, he had to act with a degree of moderation in the Middle East. And, you know, the U.S. had just been kicked out of Southeast Asia and, you know, and Eastern Europe was Eastern Europe. That was clearly squarely within the Soviet sphere. There was nothing you could do there. Nicaragua was very cautious in its foreign policy in terms of its alignment with the Soviet Union. I mean, it wound up relying more and more on the Soviets via Cuba as the Contra War became more of a crisis.
Right.
But, I mean, Nicaragua was one of the poorest countries in the hemisphere. This incredibly optimistic revolution powered by as much by liberation theology, current within Catholicism, that wanted to ally with the poor rather than the rich and that critique capitalism, critique militarism.
And believed in Jesus Christ's actual teachings.
Yeah, literacy and healthcare, but, you know, I mean,
social justice.
But Nicaragua was also a country that was squarely within the United States' sphere of it. I mean, all of Central America, going back to the 19th century, I mean, Central America is basically a province of the United States, U.S. capital, U.S. removed presidents at will, you know, over the years. And it obviously wasn't going to tolerate a social democratic nationalist revolution.
Right. See, this is just an example of how strong the propaganda is, right? Because I've studied this stuff, you know, I know who the Contras were and Oliver North. But even then, I was just like, well, no, there was the Cold War and there was the Soviet Union and there was the United States. And obviously Nicaragua was on the Soviet Union side. And yeah, they were Marxists, but who cares? But I kind of forgot that it sounds like what happened to them, there was like a Cubanization of them, right? Because Cuba didn't start out so aligned with the Soviet Union, but then because of the U.S.'s attacks on them, they were pushed into that corner.
Yeah.
And also, as you said, I mean, why doesn't, you know, shockingly enough, you're not going to believe it, but Sidney Ember, shockingly enough, does not refer to the liberation theological currents in Central America.
She obviously
doesn't know what that is, honestly. But yeah.
I mean, this starts to get tangential, but liberation theology is important because that was the first political religion that the new right squared off against before it moved on to Islam. And liberation theology was a powerful moral challenge to, I mean, it was absolutely earth-shaking in Central America and Latin America, where the Catholic Church had been a pillar of the colonial order and then the capitalist oligarchic order, and to have this moral and theological upheaval within the Catholic Church, in which providing theological justification for opposition and resistance. And so a lot of the...
But it's not tangential, I feel like, because it's actually...
No, it's not tangential at all.
Right. Its absence is remarkable, right?
Yeah, its absence is remarkable. Yeah.
Doesn't come into any of the framing of what was happening. And of course, one of the people who was killed was Romero, Oscar Romero, right? So,
yeah.
But I mean, I'm just embarrassed, honestly, to be totally stream of consciousness-ish. I'm kind of embarrassed because I realize, like, to be fair, there's so many examples of media malpractice in this piece, but I kind of forgot that one of the big things that one of Ember's crimes was that she totally didn't even bother mentioning liberation theology. I mean, there's not a single mention of it.
The 1980s, Sanders was obviously part of a of a post Vietnam left that had multiple currents, same freeze, the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, which had found, saw in Central America a continuation of the struggle. And anybody who should have a passing knowledge of the history of the United States should know this about the left in the 1980s. But was it, and it dissipates a bit in the 1990s, both as that generation moves on and as neoliberalism kind of changes the terms of politics. But Sanders Sanders represents that history in a very proud way.
In other words, it's not just Marxist opposition to death squads. There's a lot
of course.
And what do you say to people who say stuff like, well, Ortega has done some bad stuff now, and he did some bad stuff then. I mean, that's what she tries to do, Ember. Can you kind of shed light on the false equivalence of that?
Oh, well, there's no comparison. I mean, well, at the time, the Sandinista government took measures in order. I mean, they were fighting the largest, most powerful empire in world history that was fighting, particularly in the eastern part of the country, in the Mosquito Coast region, they did take measures that were, in retrospect, hard to defend, except in the context of war.
Right.
But it was a war that was forced on them.
Right.
In terms of Daniel Ortega now, I mean, I think that's a long history, and there are plenty of people who have broke with the current iteration of the Sandinistas and Daniel Ortega, who would not in any way repudiate the Sandinista revolution itself, particularly in 1985. For Nicaragua, this was a war that was forced on them. It was, they had no choice but either capitulate or fight back. And for the United States, it was totally a war of choice, which the U.S. decided that it was going to bring the full weight of its power down on one of the poorest countries in the hemisphere.
Another interesting thing is that she says, now as Sanders competes for the Democratic presidential nomination, Mr. Sanders' profound skepticism of American power appears to set him apart from other major candidates who have pledged to restore the country's traditionally assertive global role. I don't know what she means. She means by restoring it. I didn't know it went away. She mentions the invasion of Grenada. And what she links to is an article that the New York Times published in the 80s that was a summary of the government's reasons for it. Like, you can't make it up.
No, it's really just remarkable.
Yeah.
It could be continued, the conversation.
Yeah, definitely. And
it's always fun.
Yeah, and I want to have you on to talk about the book, too, which is really great.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
More thing I just have to do in full disclosure. I have to say that, you and Sanders both have similar accents, and you both do the R at the end when there is no R, like idea.
And you take it away when there is one.
Right. So I have to disclose that, for full transparency, so people can decide whether or not your support of him is tribalist or not.
I gotta go tend to my money tree.
Nice. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for
right.
Bye, Greg.
Greg Grandin is a historian and NYU professor of history and the author of a number of prize-winning books, including most recently, The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. He's also the author of The Empire of Necessity, Slavery, Freedom, and Deception in the New World, which won the Bancroft Prize in American History and was shortlisted for the Samuel Johnson Prize in the UK. NPR's Maureen Corrigan on Fresh Air named The Empire of Necessity as the best book of 2014, both nonfiction and fiction. He's also the author of Fordlandia, The Rise and Fall of Henry Ford's Forgotten Jungle City, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in History, as well as for the National Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award. Fordlandia was picked by the New York Times, New Yorker, Boston Globe, Chicago Tribune, and NPR for their best of lists. Whoa, Toni Morrison called it compelling, brilliant, and necessary. Wow, that's really cool. Other books by Greg include Empire's Workshop, Latin America, United States, and the Rise of the New Empire, The Last Colonial Massacre, Latin America During the Cold War, Blood of Guatemala, A History of Race and Nation, which won the Latin American Studies Association's Bryce Wood Award for the best book published on Latin America in any discipline. A professor of history at NYU and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, Grandin writes on U.S. foreign policy, Latin America, genocide, and human rights. He's published in the New York Times, Harper's, the London Review of Books, The Nation, the Boston Review, the LA Times, and the American Historical Review. He has been a frequent guest on Democracy Now! Grandin also served as a consultant to the United Nations Truth Commission on Guatemala and has been the recipient of a number of prestigious fellowships, including the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Fellowship. Wow. Really great writer. He's also the author of Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman. And you can also find out more about Greg at greggrandin.com. And you can follow him on Twitter at Greg Grandin. Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. The Katie Halper Show is produced by Joshua Bregman, edited by Ted Reedy, and our theme song is by the band Cordoba.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.